Okay, now we're ready.
Now we're ready for the super word.
Hey, little guy.
Questions. What county is the most important screen for in a school system?
Seven
Rocks. Four of the Mavericks.
Seven
Rocks. Well, how do you know it's Seven Rocks? What does it look like? What does it look like on McConkie? What are we looking for?
Non-fermenters.
Most of the pathogens are non-fermenters. That doesn't mean they all are. But when we say non-fermenter, what are we talking about? Lactose. Okay? Not glucose, but lactose. So we look for the non-fermenters first.
Did you say lactose or galactose?
Lactose.
Why lactose?
It's just a characteristic that most Enterobacteriaceae, the normal flora, will ferment, but pathogens will not. You know, as opposed to other sugars, because they all ferment glucose. But as I mentioned, there are some pathogens that do ferment lactose, so you can't just rely on that. But that's what we're going to screen for. That's what we'll look for initially, is the non-fermenters. Is it necessary to screen colonies with oxidase? Why not? What is one of the general characteristics of Enterobacteriaceae?
They're
all oxidase negative, right? But in 2 weeks, we're going to talk about some other pathogens that are not Enterobacteriaceae that are oxidase positive. So that's why we screen. Because they're going to look the same on media as the Enterobacteriaceae, but we're going to have to screen colonies, so you always do oxidase to pick out those that are oxidase positive, because those can be pathogens as well. How can you tell which colonies on SBA are fermenters or non-fermenters?
On
SBA.
Can't.
Well, what do you do?
You have to use
CSI.
No. You don't put from SBA to McConkie. What do? From SBA.
TSI.
There you go. Yes. Yeah.
I got
that.
Yeah. You said no.
I
missed
it.
TSI.
It.
Yeah.
Okay. Secret word. TSI. No.
We already have the secret word.
Secret.
Okay. So how do you inoculate TSI?
Staff
where?
To the bottom.
All the way to the bottom. Right? All the way to the bottom. And street. Okay? So what do non-fermenters look like on TSI?
They don't change color.
K over A. Non-fermenters are K over A. Remember, the butt is always going to be yellow. Because what's being fermented in the butt? Glucose. But the slant, if they are non-fermenters, they can't ferment lactose, so the slant reverts back to red. Okay. So hopefully you'll have a bunch of TSIs to read today. Now, here we go. On with the lecture. Okay. So diarrhea is the most common disorder that we're looking for when we get stool samples. A definition of diarrhea, well, it just means, the word means just a flowing through.
Flowing
through, yes. But the clinical definition is 3 or more unformed stools per day. Liquid, loose, soft. Is that our definition of unformed stool? Okay. See, now you guys can have this conversation over lunch or something. I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm talking about
pudding. Okay, we can divide diarrhea symptoms into non-infective and infective. The non-infective are the food poisoning. So we don't have to be infected with the organism. We just consume the toxin. So we're going to talk about that later in 2 weeks. This week or today, we're going to talk about the infective forms, which are caused by the actual organism, and those can be either toxigenic or invasive. Okay, let's start with toxigenic diarrhea, first of all. Okay, in general, the bacteria adhere to the villi. This is, let's go down right here, first of all, this is small bowel disease. Okay, so this is mostly the small intestine. So the bacteria will adhere to the villi of the small intestine. And what they do is interfere with the pumping action of electrolytes and water, and so it forces excessive amounts of electrolytes and water into the intestine. And that's where the diarrhea comes from. So the toxin interferes with that pumping mechanism. Okay, usually they don't invade the tissue, so for that reason, it doesn't usually stimulate the immune system or the inflammatory reaction, so there's generally no fever. If there is a fever, it's just a very mild fever. The main problems are the fluid loss and the electrolyte loss. And if a person dies from that, if they get a real severe diarrhea, what they die from is the fluid loss and the electrolyte loss. So that's what we have to be careful of, and particularly in children. It doesn't take as much for them to lose. Pain and cramping upon defecation. The word is tenesmus. You heard that word before? Okay. Plus or minus, which means they may or may not have that. It's not a big symptom in diarrhea, but it's possible they can have that. Okay, causative agents can be caused by a virus. I've just listed a couple here. There are more than these, rotavirus, Norwalk virus. Rotavirus is a major cause of pediatric diarrhea. Now, we don't usually look for viruses in the lab, so if the doc wants a virus, that either has to be sent off to a lab that does viral cultures, or we do antigen antibody studies.
They gave him a rotavirus vaccine that was oral. Does that act against him?
Hopefully.
That's the idea?
That's the idea, yeah.
But why because, is it still so common?
Well, there's still a lot of people who don't get all the vaccinations that they should for their children. And it's probably more common in third world countries than it is in this country, because they just don't have the medical system that we have, the health care system, and the access to the vaccines and medications. Okay, it can be caused by parasites. Those of you who've had parasitology, there's probably a longer list than this that can cause those, but Giardia is probably the most common one. Cryptosporidia, histolytica. Okay, and then bacterial. Of course, this is what we're concerned with. Now, if the doc suspects parasite, then as I mentioned the other day, he's going to request an O&P. That's what we call it, the ova and parasites. Where we have to mix up the stool sample and kind of like a milkshake and then look for ova and parasites. Okay, so bacterial, these are causative agents. Yeah. Moose tracks or something.
Yeah.
Okay. E. coli, salmonella. I put shigella in parentheses because this usually causes dysentery. What's the difference between diarrhea and dysentery? Dysentery is a bloody diarrhea, more invasive. We're going to talk about that next. But on occasions when it's mild, shigella can cause a diarrhea. Okay, these others, Vibrio cholera, Yersinia, Aeromonas pleuropneumonis, Clostridium difficile, we're going to talk about in 2 weeks. So we'll just forget those for now.
Wait,
the last five. The last five we talked about in GI week 2. Okay, how are these organisms transmitted? By the fecal-oral route, which means it gets into the water or our food, usually, or it gets on our hands or whatever, and then we can contaminate. So there's either inadequate public health measures to protect the water system, or there's inadequate personal hygiene. What are the five Fs of transmission?
Fomites?
Feces, fingers, food, flies.
Five
F's of transmission.
Really?
Really.
Lies.
Yeah. Lies, yeah. They can land on cow poop and then fly around and land on your salad or something. Lots of things that they can do. Okay, so just maintain the good personal hygiene and make sure there's no breakdown in the sewage system or the water system. Okay, and that's the problem. That's the problem that happens in these third world countries, and that's the problem that happens when we, like in Haiti, where you've got this massive earthquake and people that don't have adequate facilities, you often see these diseases that follow that. Okay, it can be easily treated if you have access to these ingredients. We call it fluid rehydration. In a liter of water, all you need is a half a teaspoon of salt, fourth a teaspoon of bicarbonate, sodium bicarbonate, fourth a teaspoon of potassium chloride, and 4 tablespoons of sugar. And just mix up that in a liter of water and drink that, and that will replace the electrolytes in the water. So most of it's easily treated. However, these are household ingredients except potassium chloride. We don't have that around the house, and that could be potentially lethal. So they have these little rehydration packets. They're just little packets, like little baggies with this stuff in it. And they distribute these, particularly in the third world countries where there are massive problems. And the people then just have to mix that up with water.
Where do you get bicarbonate? Is that from
tongue? Just sodium bicarbonate. You can buy little blocks of baking soda.
Yeah, baking
soda. Just baking soda is sodium bicarbonate.
So for kids, like my kids, they have that Pedialyte.
Pedialyte contains the electrolytes, the sugar that's in there. And it's probably got potassium, maybe not in the form of potassium chloride, but it's the salt will have the chloride in it.
I'm sorry?
You can make popsicles out of it now.
Ooh.
Really?
They do. They are so good.
Oh, like another question for you.
Oh.
What do you give a sick bird?
Rocks.
He doesn't want any more medicine. You guys just had too much hematology. You're not appreciating wine. Yeah. Okay, so dysentery then. On to dysentery. This is invasive. So the difference between dysentery and diarrhea is this is more invasive, and therefore we end up with a bloody diarrhea. So a bloody diarrhea is termed the dysentery. It's large, or usually the large bowel, which is the large intestine, that gets invaded. Tissue invasion. So because of the deeper invasion of the tissues, the immune system is stimulated, the inflammatory system is stimulated more. So we're more likely to see white blood cells, red blood cells, mucus flux in the stool sample than we would with just regular diarrhea. Fever is quite common. Usually they have fever because of the inflammatory reaction. And the tinnitus is quite common in dysentery. So symptoms are a little bit different. Okay, for causative agents, there are no viral agents that cause dysentery. They don't invade because they're intracellular. They just get inside cells, and that's how they replicate. They don't invade tissues. Parasites, again, kind of the same ones as spongiolitis. Giardia, the most common one. How do we get Giardia? I was hiking in Zion Park a couple years ago, and I snapped this picture of a person drinking out of the street water.
That's gross.
Did you just call him Giardia?
Do you recognize that person?
That Bob Giardia.
That's me.
That's you?
That's me.
That's you. Giardia.
I staged this just for you guys. I was not there for the water.
You're drinking.
Well, I've got my water bottle right there. So, no, that's really me, and I just thought, this would be great for the students, so I just kind of posed for that. Just to emphasize, that's how we usually get Giardia.
So here's the picture next year.
What's that?
I'm going to use that next year.
Okay.
But I'm going to lie.
Okay. Say it's you.
Okay.
Okay, when my cats, when we first adopted her, she was a stray, they're all strays, she came with a Giardia infection.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty stinky. Okay, bacterial agents, E. coli, Clostridium difficile, which we're going to talk about in 2 weeks, Shigella, and Salmonella, I put here in parentheses, because that's more likely to be a diarrhea on occasion. With a large infection, it can be invasive and cause dysentery, then Campylobacter and Yersinia, again, we're going to talk about in 2 weeks. Okay, let's do a little bit more on Salmonella. You can read in your textbook about how we name the Salmonella organisms, and it's changing constantly. Usually, well, what they've decided now is that there are only two species, and now it's not Cholera suis anymore, it's Enterica, which is what your textbook says. So Salmonella Enterica and Salmonella Bongori are the only two species that are accepted as species. The others are subspecies or serotypes of these. So the naming is of Salmonella is quite complex. So just kind of that section in your book. When we identify Salmonella in the lab, we're not going to speciate. We're not going to serotype. That requires antiserum. We'll just call it Salmonella, so we won't care what species it is. This just shows a table that was in the last edition of the textbook before this changed, Color Suis, which would be now Enterica. This is the group that's most pathogenic for humans, so they're all going to be in that species. But when we name them, usually like these, Hyphenurium and Erythritis, these are not really species names. These are subspecies of Cerevar names, but it doesn't really matter that much to us as far as naming them or what we call them. Okay, so we talk about three diseases that Salmonella causes. The most common one that we experience in the laboratory for which we get stool samples, or we may not get stool samples. People may just experience this disorder. Usually it's self-limiting, which means it resolves itself in 2 to 5 days, so patients don't often go to the doc for diarrhea. They just suffer through the consequences. So we don't always get stool samples for this, but it's called enterocolitis or just salmonellosis. And it can be caused by a couple different agents, Typhimurium, Enteritidis, there's others, but again, we're just going to call it salmonella. It produces an enterotoxin. That's its virulence factor, and that's why it's a diarrhea, or a toxigenic diarrhea rather than invasive. So how do we get it? Again, contaminated food and water. And the most common food is poultry, beef, eggs. So here's our poultry, laying an egg. My neighbor has a goose, a pet goose, and they named it Pops. And the other day, they found 2 eggs in the stroller.
Whoops.
It jumped up into the stroller and laid it. It's not a Pops. So, cook poultry. Make sure you cook your chicken well. Usually do not eat raw eggs because the eggs can be contaminated. Beef, hamburgers. This is usually for processing the meat, so it gets cross-contaminated during the processing. Dairy products, milk, even ice cream has had.
Remember how you said that you used to make those shakes with the egg whites?
Of the whole egg.
Oh, you used the whole egg?
I used the whole egg.
Oh,
that's raw egg. Because
I was going to ask if,
you want the recipe?
The white of the egg.
No.
I was going to ask if the white of the egg was, less likely to have a GERD or something.
Not necessarily. Because it can come from the mother as she's developing the egg. The organism can pass through into the development of the egg. Or sometimes as the egg is laid, it gets a little crack in a shell. And if the organism is in the environment, it can get through the crack in the shell that way.
Okay, I heard that in old times they used to eat ground beef, raw.
Raw ground beef?
Yeah, is that true?
Who?
Like an old time, somebody's...
Yeah, I know some people
do that. They do?
What's that, Tyler?
I know some people who do that. They eat ground beef.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. Well, if the meat processing plant is very stringent in their controls of how they process it, then the meat's not going to be infected. But if they're not, and particularly if they've butchered chickens first, and then they use the same area without really cleaning it for the beef, then you can get cross contamination that way. Or you can get contamination of the beef from the feces of the beef if it gets contaminated that way. So it's possible, but if they're as stringent as they should be, then it's not as likely to get it. But eating raw ground beef is not a good idea. Contaminated water. Okay, again, this person that's a carrier that can transmit it. What about this? We eat turtles. You don't have to really eat a turtle. Pet turtles. Some pets.
Pet turtles. Yeah.
Yeah. Pet turtles.
Not too long ago, they
had pet turtles. Yeah. And you see frequently, or not frequently, but periodically, you read in the news about products, lettuce, things that have had to be recalled because of salmonella or E. coli. About eggs?
Yeah.
Well, it's not as much as a problem, probably, again, as it used to be because of the more stringent controls. Like I mentioned last semester, I used to have a raw egg, a milkshake, homemade milkshake every morning.
And she turned out fine.
And I never got sick. Never had cholesterol problem. Never had salmonellosis. I'd mix up my raw egg in a glass of milk with some wheat germ and a ripe banana and blend it for 29 seconds. That was the secret. And it would keep me going until lunch because it had the protein in there from the egg and it had the milk and it had the fruit and it was great. I still do it on occasion. So it has to be good ripe banana. But I never got sick from the raw egg. So,
lucky me. I can think of much yummier milkshake.
I ground it up in the milkshake?
No, I said I can think of much yummier milkshake.
Oh, okay. You try it first. Okay, symptoms of salmonellosis, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. This usually occurs anywhere between 8 to 48 hours after ingestion. The average is about 18 hours after ingestion. It takes a little time to get the organism into the intestinal tract and for the toxin to be produced and start getting symptoms. Diagnosis, stool culture, and serological. We do that's how we get the serotyping, is the serology from the O and the H antigens that we talked about before. And treatment is just fluid replacement. Just make sure you put in enough water for what you're losing and electrolytes. But again, most people probably do not seek medical attention for salmonellosis diarrhea. Okay.
They're not going to give them an antibiotic.
They can give them an antibiotic, but they usually don't because the theory is that the antibiotic might prolong a carrier state in an individual. So unless it's a really severe case, they probably will not give an antibiotic because it clears up usually within 2 to 5 days. So it's not a big problem that way. Okay, TSI. So there we have K over A, H2S. That's typical of salmonella. Negative urea, negative phenylalanine, negative indole. This is a lysine iron auger. Now, we don't use this. We haven't really talked about it, but it's another way of detecting lysine decarboxylase. And salmonella is lysine decarboxylase positive. So you can do it this way. You can use the lysine decarboxylase test that we use. Okay, a second disorder from salmonella is typhoid fever, also known as enteric fever. Again, this is one we don't see as much in this country because of vaccinations. We usually get typhoid vaccinations when we're kids. But we see it more from people who travel to endemic areas or come back into the States. Caused by Salmonella typhi and paratyphi. Salmonella typhi is the more virulent form, more severe case. Paratyphi is less virulent. It's only found in human carriers. Other animals do not transport or transmit Salmonella typhi. Fecal-oral route from a human carrier, and they usually have a very high fever, and that's what gets its name, typhoid fever, 104 degrees, that's pretty high. So it's no wonder they have malaise, or a headache, is it, with a high fever like that? What's malaise? Is it you guys have malaise?
Yeah.
I asked a student in my biology class once, what's malaise? Corn. Okay, headache, tender abdomen, and one of the characteristics is these rose spots. These are little petechial rashes that are characteristic because the organism does get from the lymph system and spreads to the blood. And then usually they have, in the first couple of weeks at least, they have constipation rather than diarrhea. So that the diarrhea doesn't start until the third or fourth week. It does have about a 10% mortality rate if it's untreated, so it can be a severe case. Diagnosis, during the first week or two, a blood culture is the best way to detect the organism. We can't find it in the stool because they don't usually have diarrhea the first couple weeks. Sometimes we'll do a stool culture, but blood is the best. And about 80% of the time, you're going to find organisms circulating in the blood. So don't be surprised if you get a blood culture along with a stool culture for some of these cases. It can be treated with antibiotics. You don't need to remember which antibiotics. But the main thing here, what is a cholecystectomy? Gallbladder. Okay. Because those people that are carriers harbor the organism in the gallbladder. That's where it replicates, and then they shed it from the gallbladder, and that's how it gets into their stool sample, and then they get contaminated. So that's, and you all heard the story of Typhoid Mary, I presume. Okay, that's where that's what she was, a carrier, because she had the organism in her gallbladder. Okay, third type of infection from Salmonella is a septicemia. This is just a like a bacteremia, which we're going to talk about that when we get into blood cultures. But if the organism gets into the blood, and it causes systemic symptoms. So rather than intestinal symptoms, GI, from diarrhea, you've got these systemic symptoms, high fever, chills, and the organism was rarely cultured from the stool, so it would probably then have to come from blood culture as well. We don't see that very often. So usually when we find salmonella, we're going to get it from a stool sample because of diarrhea. Okay, let's take a look at E. coli. Remember the reactions of E. coli? It's A over A, sometimes with gas. MR positive, BP negative, citrate negative. This is motility. You can't really see the stab because it's fuzzy from the motility, but that is not a really good picture to detect motility anyway. Okay, now most of the E. coli in the stool sample is normal flora, but occasionally we can pick up a strain that produces a toxin or has some other virulence factor that can cause diarrhea. Okay, so these stand for enteropathogenic E. coli. EPEC, enteropathogenic E. coli. This causes infant diarrhea. Not seen much in this country, but it can be quite common in other parts of the world where it can cause severe diarrhea. And again, as I mentioned, diarrhea is more problematic in infants because they don't have to lose as much fluid as they want to cause some severe problems. Okay, ETEC, enterotoxigenic E. coli. Enterotoxigenic E. coli. Okay, this is the traveler's diarrhea. Anybody have that? Travel to foreign countries?
Well, my parents have.
Yeah. Parents, yeah. Missionaries sometimes get it. Drinking water.
Brushing your teeth.
Yeah, even that from the water. Eating vegetables or fruit that haven't been washed. It produces two types of toxins. We don't really need to go into the difference here, but it stands for heat labile toxin, which is destroyed by heating, and heat stable toxin. Symptoms occur 24 to 72 hours after ingestion. It usually lasts about a week, just long enough to ruin your vacation if you happen to be traveling. Sometimes you think you're going to die, but usually people don't die from traveler's diarrhea. It's just a real nuisance to have that. So you have to be careful what you eat and drink in these places. EIEC, enteroinvasive E. coli. So this one does invade, and it produces a disorder that's similar to shigellosis. Shigella, which we're going to talk about next. And then there's...
The traveler's diarrhea? How come the people in that country don't get it from that?
They just live with it constantly.
They just walk around.
They probably initially, as children, had a case of it. But then they're just constantly exposed to it, so their body adjusts to the normal for it. It actually probably becomes normal for it.
I like there's a lot of middle countries, and like their whole life has pretty much had diarrhea, and like they just don't, they think that's normal. They have no idea that.
Yeah. They can have a mild case of normal, mild case of diarrhea. They just carry around a luggable loom. They call those things. Emergency storage. You're all supposed to have one in your storage.
We learned about premonition in
premonition?
Not premonition. What was it? Premonition. Where a low-dose infection keeps you from having... So it's the same thing with...
Same type thing. It's just endemic in that, wherever they have to live. Okay, then the one that we're most concerned with is EHEC, enterohemorrhagic E. coli. Anybody know what this is commonly known as? The hamburger bug. Okay, this first appeared several years ago from undercooked hamburger from fast food joints.
So is this from like Jack in the Box?
Yeah, it sort of started with Jack in the Box in the Seattle area. So any places now, they really have to cook their hamburger because it can be ground into the internal part of the beef patty.
It's like
the
lactose positive hamburger.
Lactose positive hamburger. Okay, the real name instead of hamburger bug is 0157H7. What do those stand for, O and H? The O is the somatic antigen, and the H is the flagellate antigen. So we can do antiserum studies to determine that. In fact, that's what we do. So this causes a severe bloody diarrhea, and now you know what HUS is. Hemolytic uremic syndrome. That from hematology, so you know more about that than I do. Thrombocytopenia. So the main problem with this is in children, because children can die from a 1,5-7-H7 infection. Adults usually just get sick, but they don't die from it. So that's the problem with the undercooked hamburgers. Okay, now, need to know, NTK. It's amazing how much I emphasize the last week, the tuberculosis, the processing, the DDC, NTK, DDC. There were still several of you that had no idea what that question on the exam meant. So, I'm telling you again, need to know. All right, how do we diagnose it? Well, the organism is going to look just like any other E. coli. In fact, all of those that we just talked about are going to look like any other E. coli. So the way we diagnose it, particularly this one, is we include a SMAC plate with our battery of media. A SMAC plate. Okay, a SMAC is a McConkie with sorbitol instead of lactose. Sorbitol instead of lactose. Because this organism is a lactose fermenter. It's going to, like I said, it's going to look like any of the others. But it does not ferment sorbitol, whereas 94% of all E. coli will ferment sorbitol. So if we put a SMAC plate in there and we get clear, colorless colonies, and we've identified it as a suspected E. coli, then this is more suspicion than it is 0-1-5-7-8-7. Now, many labs, they probably have their own protocol. They won't automatically include a SMAC plate. They will probably do it maybe only on bloody diarrhea, or maybe they will do it on bloody diarrhea and children, or a child with maybe a diagnosis or symptoms of HUS. Okay, so there's some index of suspicion. They don't automatically include that. So what's going to happen then is regular E. coli are going to be sorbitol positive, but 0-1-5-7-H7 is sorbitol negative. And then we can do the antisera for the O antigen. Okay, let's take a look at this. We don't need to know this whole flow diagram, but this pretty much says the same thing. Isolation and presumptive identification. Put down a SMAC plate. If it's positive, sorbitol positive, we'll just ignore it. It's not 0-1-5-7-H7. It's just another usually normal flora E. coli. But if it's negative, then we test, we do the antisera for the 0-1-5-7 antigen. If that's negative, again, we just disregard it, but if that's positive, then we send out a presumptive oral report of E. coli 0-1-5-7. Presumptive, meaning we suspect this is what it is based on what we've done so far, but we haven't confirmed it yet. But the doc probably needs to know that as soon as possible. So then we do the biochemicals that we usually do for identifying E. coli and make sure it is an E. coli. And then we can send out a written report. This is still presumptive at this point. Then we get into confirmation, which oftentimes goes to a reference lab, in which they now test for the H7 antigen. And if that's positive, then they can send out a final report of E. coli 0-1-5-7-H7. So the main thing you need to know is primarily the SMAC plate. What it is, what its purpose is, how we interpret it.
How common is this disease?
It depends on the location and the hospital. Most often we say Campylobacter is the most common diarrhea. We'll talk about that next week. But there are some studies that have been done in some locations, some hospitals, and they say that this is more common than Campylobacter. So it just kind of depends. Sometimes you can go for months without seeing anything like this. Okay, finally, just another fifth form, enteroaggregative E. coli, that aggregates or adheres to the mucosal surface rather than invading. Okay, so those are the pathogenic ones. And then I mentioned the other day that very rarely, but occasionally we can get a lactose-negative E. coli. That is normal flora. Okay, even though that's what we're primarily looking for, is initially screening for non-lactose fermenters. Not all of them are pathogens. This one is normal flora. Okay, let's go to Shigella. Oftentimes, the disease state is referred to as bacillary dysentery, or sometimes just shigellosis. There are four main species, Shigellosaunii, which is most common here, Flexneri, dysenteriae, which is the most severe, probably the most severe form of dysentery, but it's the least common one, fortunately. And then Shigella boidii. So again, we are not going to speciate Shigella. If we get a Shigella, we're just going to call it Shigella. Boy diarrhea, it's dysentery primarily, so you're going to have the pus, the cramping, the pain, the tenesmus, the fever, that stuff that goes along with dysentery. Here's Shigella. A couple things about Shigella. It is a very fastidious organism. And I think we noticed that in the lab yesterday. So it did not grow on McConkie. It did not grow on SSR. Or HE. So it's a little bit more difficult to deal with. And that may be just the way that we process our unknowns. Because probably coming from a person, a human with shigellosis, you would be able to culture it on those media because the hopefully the stool sample is fresh and warm. Okay, it is inert. What does inert mean? Yeah. So if you start seeing, particularly on your APIs that hopefully you will set up today, and you start reading those tomorrow or so tomorrow, you read it on Friday, they have to be read within 24 hours, and you start seeing a lot of reactions that are negative, and it is a non-lactose fermenter, so it's K over A, no gas, no H2S, then you suspect Shigella. It is non-modal. What's the other species of Enterobacteriaceae that is non-modal? The other genera?
Klebsiella.
Klebsiella. Okay, two organisms that are non-modal, Klebsiella and Shigella. Okay, again, transmitted by the fecal-oral route. Now, we don't need, this is more virulent or effective than is Salmonella, so we only need about 10 to 100 organisms to become infected, whereas with Salmonella, we need about 10 to the 6th organisms. So you need a much greater infected dose of Salmonella than you do Shigella. It is fragile in feces, as we've already mentioned. Fragile meaning temperature changes and pH changes. It doesn't withstand that as readily as some of the more hardy organisms. It produces a toxin, which we call sugar toxin, and because it causes a dysentery, it is invasive. Oh, in my travels, I came across a T-shirt.
You actually bought it?
Oh, I bought
it.
Yeah,
are you kidding? Oh,
wow. Endangered feces.
I want that shirt. That's a family union shirt.
I found this up in my uncle's West Yellowstone. Yeah, Yellowstone. That's where I got it. Over here it says, no species, no feces. I'm not sure what that means, but yeah, I just can't bear to wear it because it's just a classic that I have to keep it, so it's never been worn. Okay, I think we're through, so let's take 10 extra minutes and spend on our lab work. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe I do have something else here. Oh, I do. This is what's happening next week. Let me just clue you in. Remember that Monday is a holiday. We all need a holiday right now? Okay, but it's a good study day. Even if it doesn't rain or snow, it's a good study day. Okay, so we come to class. Tuesday is actually Monday. For the whole world, it's a Tuesday, but for BYU, it's Monday. So we will have Monday classes. That means lecture at 9 o'clock sharp. No stragglers. No dawdling. And lab, and we're going to do non-fermenters. And there will be no exam next week, because there's no Tuesday. Which means the following Tuesday, GI and no exam. Which will be through with me following. So your entire focus needs to be my